In Schumann's String Quartet in A minor, we heard the Hagen Quartet, Lucas Hagen and Rainer Schmidt, Veronika Hagen and Clemens Hagen. Tomorrow we'll be hearing from Schumann's dramatic works, including his scenes from Goethe's Faust and his only opera, Genoveva.
And that was Donald MacLeod. Well, a very good evening to you. Welcome along to BBC Radio 3 from me, Ian Skelly. I'm here to guide you through our programmes tonight, which includes two visits to the BBC proms and a night of contrasts, a brand new symphony by Philip Glass in our late prom, and in a moment we celebrate light music.
BBC Radio 3 at Proms Plus. Free events across the 2013 proms season, capturing the musical, literary and artistic background to some of the featured music and themes. Go to the Radio 3 website or the BBC iPlayer radio app to hear some of the Proms Plus events so far, including author John le Carré celebrating 50 years since the publication of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold.
We all of us instinctively incline towards the conspiratorial moment and, quite simply, the patriotic moment.
BBC Proms Plus. Go online to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
So let's off to the proms then, and a special prom tonight. We're joined by BBC Radio 2. It's presented by Petroc Trelawney and Ken Bruce.
Yes, hello, good evening. This is Ken Bruce, welcoming all Radio 3 listeners to Radio 2.
And this is Petroc Trelawney, welcoming all Radio 2 listeners to Radio 3.
We are a sort of cut-price version of the two Ronnies here this evening, but we don't even have one candle between us, let alone four.
I thought we were very upmarket in terms of our two Ronnying. Yes, every prom is live on Radio 3 as ever, but this year we're particularly thrilled to welcome Radio 1, 1 Extra, 4 Extra, 6 Music, BBC Asian Network, and tonight, Radio 2.
Yes, indeed, and tonight's concert is all English, given by our very own BBC Concert Orchestra, stalwarts of Radio 2's Friday Night is Music Night, of course. The second half will be nodding in that direction with some favourites from the programme. Be music with The Royal Connection by Eric Coates and William Walton, as well as Malcolm Arnold's English Dances, and there's going to be a medley of good old BBC Radio signature tunes woven together by that master arranger, Gordon Langford.
Notebooks at the ready. We're going to start with one of the featured composers here at the proms this season, Granville Bantock. He was born in 1868, brought up just across Hyde Park from the Royal Albert Hall in London's Notting Hill. Streaks of idiosyncrasy and romanticism coloured Bantock's life and his music as well.
Yes, and the music, as she goes on to say, is complementing perfectly the theatricality of his melodic gestures. Well, coming on stage now is the leader of the BBC Concert Orchestra, the leader for these many years, Cynthia Fleming.
And that work of Granville Bantock that starts our concert, his comedy overture, Piero of the Minute, sparkling, rumbustious, and seldom heard.
Indeed, it's one I've never been aware of until now. I heard it at rehearsal for the first time, and it's an enjoyable piece.
The orchestra stands as Barry Wordsworth makes his way centre stage to open this very special prom, live on Radio 3 and Radio 2, with Granville Bantock's Piero of the Minute. Thank you.
A seldom heard piece for a seldom heard composer, Granville Bantock's Pierrot of the Minute, the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Barry Wordsworth.
Well, we promised you a big royal focus during tonight's concert, and next, Elgar's Nursery Suite, written in 1930. He was master of the King's music at this time, wrote it shortly after the birth of Princess Margaret and dedicated it to her. A series of seven movements, including Doll's Serious, Sad and Merry, starts with a child waking up, concludes with a lovely dream. A wagon passes through in the middle. Nursery Suite by Elgar. Barry Wordsworth conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sir Edward Elgar's Nursery Suites, written in 1930 on the occasion of the birth of Princess Margaret, dedicated to her, the Queen and Elizabeth, Duchess of York, their mother. Cynthia Fleming playing the violin cadenza in that last movement. Wonderful flute playing too from principal flautist of the BBC Concert Orchestra, Ileana Ruhrmann. Barry Wordsworth conducting the orchestra in this Wednesday night prom, live on BBC Radio 3 and BBC Radio 2.
Great applause for Barry Wordsworth and the orchestra, and well deserved too. Beautiful rendition of Elgar's Nursery Suite.
Orchestra just back from China. They've been on a major tour.
A very successful tour of China. And some of the programme that's being played tonight was played in that tour. Bit of reorganisation going on here now in the Royal Albert Hall. Not just one, but two grand pianos are going to be manoeuvred into place at the front of the stage. Some of the orchestra members are just getting off there as the stagehands here at the Royal Albert Hall come in to move some of the seats to get the pianos on. The reason for the two pianos is that to take us up to the interval, the BBC Concert Orchestra and Barry Wordsworth will be joined by two fabulous pianists.
No expense spared.
Oh, absolutely none. I had to play Malcolm Arnold's Concerto for Two Pianos at Three Hands. We'll explain that a little bit later on. But let's hear what tonight's pianists, Catherine Stott and Noriko Ogawa, have to say about it.
Normally, when we've played with orchestra, I've been sitting next to the violins, and so actually before we'd even looked at this music or before we knew who had two hands or one hand, we just decided that we would stick in that position, and whoever got the right-hand part, that's what would happen, and as it happens, that's me, Kathy.
Well, you might think that one-hand part has got only just half the job, but actually it's not. It seems very tricky, because Kathy has to use a lot of number four and number five fingers, which are weaker than the others. So actually, I think it's turned out to be harder, don't you think, Kathy?
Oh, definitely, yes. I have to eat extra Weetabix this morning.
For me, playing with another pianist is easier, especially with Kathy. It's very inspiring because I can just copy exactly what she's done.
And that's also not true.
And also, she can actually disguise some of my mistakes. So, I quite like it. But the only problem is the distance. We are about 4 or 5 meters away from each other. That's the only thing. So every time I have to make sure that Kathy is not right next to me.
Noriko's always incredibly modest and very kind about my playing. But actually, I think we complement each other very well because in reality, we've got quite different styles. So we're not playing with exactly the same colour. But to me, that's a very positive aspect of our partnership.
The first movement has got a very dark colour to start with. It is quite spectacular, but there is something really quite dark about it. Our second movement is very romantic, and we can really enjoy it. The third movement is probably the most difficult, technically speaking. There is one or two particular parts which are very demanding for us, but the most joyful, and I am hoping that we will be able to bring some smile in audience faces.
Well, I'm sure they will. Catherine Stott and Noriko Ogawa are two soloists who will be joining us in a moment or two. The reason for the three hands, Malcolm Arnold was commissioned by the BBC to write this piece and actually gave its first performance here at the Royal Albert Hall in August of 1969. The BBC Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Sir Malcolm Arnold himself. And the pianists on that occasion were the husband and wife duo Phyllis Selick and Cyril Smith. And the piece was written for them. Cyril Smith had suffered a stroke in 1956, which had paralysed his left arm. He continued to play in concert with his wife, hence the three hands for that piece.
I think listening on the radio, you may think that Kathy Stott, who is playing the one-armed role, is cheating because she has so many notes and so much energy, but it is her right hand. Her left hand is sort of clamped under her knee.
Yeah, she's taking great care not to use the left hand. And you may have heard, I'm not quite sure whether you did, while the change was taking place, the traditional heave-ho from the promise here whenever the piano lid is raised.
This is another moment of tradition.
Cynthia Fleming, the leader of the orchestra, plays the A on the piano, and the promenaders cheer her to the echo. So she plays it again, and the orchestra retune to that note. This is a great piece by Malcolm Arnold. He had a great feel for what the public wanted. Mm. And in his film music, you heard that. And there are hints of his film music in this piece as well, especially towards the end. There are only three short movements to this. In my sort of terminology, they're fast, slow, and fast. And the last of them is a really bright, jolly piece, a sort of rumba rhythm, and I think you will feel that you've heard something of that before, perhaps in the St. Trinian's films.
Yes, I mean, he was such a prolific composer for the cinema, and particularly dozens and dozens of film scores, plus, of course, all those sets of dances, English, Scottish, Cornish, Welsh. We'll get one of those later on, but right now, Catherine Stott and Noriko Ogawa, wearing red and turquoise, respectively, make their way to the two pianos. Pianos sort of embracing each other at the front of the Royal Albert Hall stage.
Yes, Barry Wordsworth, tucked together, aren't they?
It's rather lovely, isn't it?
Very, very romantic.
Barry Wordsworth conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra, Malcolm Arnold's Concerto for Two Pianos, Three Hands.
Well, a massive cheer here in the Royal Albert Hall for our two soloists, our conductor and our orchestra, and Malcolm Arnold's Concerto for Two Pianos, Three Hands. A very typical Malcolm Arnold piece, veering from gentleness to excitement in the space of a few seconds, and always with that underlying wit there. And some delicate playing, as well as robustious playing at times, from Catherine Stott and Norika Ogawa. We've been presented with bouquets of flowers, and are now leaving the stage, as is Barry Wordsworth, but I don't think they'll be allowed to go as easily as that.
Very difficult to listen to Malcolm Arnold's music without a big smile on the face.
It's true. He lulls you into this very serious moment, and then he can't keep it up for long, it seems. He's got to bring you back down with a smile on your face and a laugh, almost.
And such vitality, such energy, and just the range. You know, 120 film scores, I think, a whole series of symphonies, so much music for special occasion. Lots of people say Malcolm Arnold's been neglected at the Proms in recent years, but he's back tonight.
And deservedly so. A bow for Catherine Stott and Norika Ogawa. Barry Wordsworth invites the members of the orchestra to stand and take their applause too. Busy Albert Hall tonight. Only one or two seats vacant. An enthusiastic audience here who are enjoying every moment of it. And much more to enjoy in part two.
Absolutely. More Malcolm Arnold ahead. His English dances. More music with a royal connection as well. Not one, but three Elizabeths to celebrate in part two. And notebooks at the ready as we charge at breakneck speed through just about every radio signature tune of the 50s, 60s and 70s.
Even further back, I think, some of them, the 30s and 40s in some cases as well, which even further than I can go back, Petrov, I have to say. Norika Ogawa and Catherine Stott returning to the stage to receive the plaudits of the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall once again. Big smiles on their faces, and rightly so, because they played beautifully, and the audience here are only too keen to show their appreciation.
I was just thinking of the tragedy that Cyril Smith must have thought had overtaken his life when he lost the use of his left arm, but how amazing that that career continued in such style and prompted people like Malcolm Arnold to write such sparkling words.
A beautiful piece written specifically for that couple who were such good musicians.
Well, Radio 2 and Radio 3, Ken Bruce and Petrop Trelawney live together this Wednesday night at the Royal Albert Hall, home of the BBC Proms throughout this summer. During the interval, Proms Plus, our pre-concert event, which took place a little earlier today, across the way at the Royal College of Music. It's presented by Matthew Sweet.
Yes, better check this is working first. Hello, campers. Heidi, hi. For years, light music has been banished to the darkness of lifts, the darkness of pages from CFAX, the darkness of your call is very important to us. Tonight, at the Albert Hall, a little bit of that darkness has been dispelled. Now we're going to explore what that gloom obscured, a form of music that once surged from the wireless, from palm courts and bandstands, from the tannoy system at Butlins. Here in the Hawaiian Ballroom at the Royal College of Music, we're joined by two men with an ear for post-war culture. Are they former Ovaltinis? No. Did they ever support Dorothy Squires in summer season? No, I'm not going to claim that. But they are two of our most thoughtful and literate journalists. Simon Heffer, columnist, cultural historian, Essex boy, and Andrew O'Hagan, novelist, UNICEF ambassador, and essayist. And both deserving, I think, of the kind of applause with which you might greet Semprini or the Simon Parks Orchestra. So let's hear it. Now, perhaps we could begin by doing something dangerous and daring, Simon. What is light music? Is there a way of describing it, defining it?
Well, I've always thought it was a particularly British thing. I mean, I believe there is foreign light music, but let's not confuse the issue with that now. I think it started around the time of the Great War, along really with the invention of the gramophone and the coming of the wireless. And it had its heyday right the way through until, I suppose, about 1960, when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were invented. And it was a lighter, diluted form, but by and large, of classical music. And it was often written by people who had been trained as classical musicians, many who came through this college, indeed, who became very distinguished composers of light music. And it was short in duration, and it was melodic. It had tunes, and it was of instant appeal without being cheap or trivial.
So is there something that we can hear that defines light music, Andrew? Or is it something that arises from the context, or you know, where you hear it?
I think we can hear it right away. I mean, what we hear is a sort of optimism, a sort of uplift. I mean, it's almost going out of fashion, the notion that music could be uplifting, that tunefulness could be a real addition to your day. But I think it was a cornerstone of British light music, and certainly of the light programme, as it was called at the time. The uplift, people coming in from their work with a need for a certain kind of optimistic, nostalgic tunefulness was a real bonus. And I think that that's how it seems to me. You know, it's a form of music that actually is ingrained, if you like. It's part of the DNA of Britishness now, that you hear that music, and it's so much of it has been used as signature theme music, has been used as part of advertising. And really, whenever you want to sum up what it's like to be British, you wouldn't immediately reach for Vaughan Williams or Elgar in the popular imagination. You'd reach for British light music.
But you described it as dilute, Simon. Is it something that gives you a first taste of something before you can enjoy the stronger stuff? Is it something that you graduate from?
Well, I think in some cases it was. And I mean, Andrew's right to talk about people coming in the evening and turning on the light programme. And the BBC, the existence of the BBC after 1922 and the explosion in light music are not coincidental. One really followed the other. The BBC was one of the great patrons of light music in the period just before and just after the war. And I think many people saw it as an end in itself. But yes, I think for a lot of people, it was a way into classical music, particularly for children. I mean, we're all of a certain age. I remember growing up in the 1960s and hearing theme tunes written by people like Eric Coates and Haydn Wood, who were very distinguished composers in their own right. And it gave you certainly an interest in tunefulness. And it was, of course, it was of short duration. If you're a young person with a limited attention span, it's a very good way of getting into reasonably serious music. And yes, of course, if you're that way inclined, you will move on to something else.
Andrew, is it music with something taken out there? I mean, is it to music what the Reader's Digest is to the novel?
Well, it's often, I suppose, it would be possible to think of it anyway as British music with the pomposity taken out. And given that there is quite a lot of pomposity, not only in British music, but in music generally, it's actually light without necessarily being lightweight. I think it bears the same relation to perhaps a good piece of writing as picture postcards do. If you're interested in picture postcards and in a certain view of British life, as you mentioned at the beginning, Palm Court orchestras, End of the Pier, a certain kind of cheapness too, because of course cheap music's a bit like cheap perfume. It can be acrid, but it can be quite sexy as well. And I like that about light music, that it actually gives out to a good time. The idea is that people went out on a Saturday night and really sort of, you know, responded to this music.
Okay, well, let's listen to a piece that seems to fall very safely within the category of light music. I'm sure many of you will know this. This is by Eric Coates, and it's called Calling All Workers. I think this is a useful place to start talking about what this kind of music is for, really. I mean, you know, I wonder whether this is a kind of music that speaks to a particular historical moment where a sort of collectivism was very valued.
It's motivational music. It's about women predominantly in the Second World War in factories while the men are away trying to kill Nazis, in factories building aircraft, building munitions, and it's about being cheerful. It's that sort of atmosphere that's captured in films like Millions Like Us, about, to use a horrible phrase, we are all in it together. And it's music as a unifying sentiment, it's music as a unifying force. And for that reason, it shouldn't be underestimated. And it's when you hear that music, even if you weren't alive in 1942, you know that you're back in 1942, and you know that you're part of that very noble collective effort to save this country.
And yet its appeal outlasted the war, didn't it, Andrew? I mean, this music could have been heard on the radio until the 60s.
It did, because I think one of the clichés often expressed about British light music is that it's nostalgic. But if you really listen to that music and witness its subject, it's often about austerity Britain on the move. There's a lot of planes, boats and trains in this music. It's no accident that you have sailing by. It's no accident that you have the kind of music where you feel modernity pushing this rather traditional island people forward into the future. A lot of this music ended up being used on those public information films about how we were going to live now that we'd won the war. We're in a post-ration book world, and we were really going to get ourselves together now and move into the future. So, I mean, so much so that Ron Goodwin, one of the great British light music composers, wrote such good music for planes that people would say, if there was a war movie involving planes, get Ron Goodwin immediately. You know, they all had their area, and it was a kind of modernity they were dealing in, not just the old-fashioned, the dead world.
You asked me earlier how to define light music, and I wish I'd thought of this then. I mean, to an extent, light music is classical music for the masses, and that's why there's a lot of snobbery about it, because some people who like classical music say, actually, I don't want the masses to become involved. I don't want them to share this with me, because they won't understand it in the way that I do. And I mean, that's a very unfortunate idea. But classical music was a way, in a society that was being slowly more educated and slowly more civilized, to bring people nearer to classical music, to use a dreadful word, to make it more accessible.
We've asked you both to pick a favorite piece that you can unpack and describe for us. What have you chosen, Simon?
I've chosen The Horse Guards Whitehall by Haydn Wood from his suite London Landmarks.
Let's hear it. So what does that conjure for you, Simon?
Well, it's Down Your Way. That was every Sunday evening at 5 o'clock, that piece of music came on the home service. Many people here will remember Down Your Way. It was a programme that went out into villages and towns around Britain and spoke to the people there. And it, to me, sums up communities, people in Britain, all in it together, all in the common purpose of getting on and being British, if you like. And that piece of music, I think, went out every Sunday for about 30 years.
Is it possible to disentangle those feelings about it that you have? You know, its sense of being, you know, rather like Proust's Madeleine in some way, and say something about its musical qualities, or is that absolutely impossible?
No, it's not impossible. Haydn Wood, who wrote it, was an alumnus of his college, and he was a composition pupil of Sir Charles Villiers Stanford. So he was no mean composer and no mean intellect. And he was one of the great, if you like, pop musicians of his day. He wrote in 1916 Roses of Picardy, which is one of the most famous songs of the 20th century. And he wrote a piece of music there which is in many ways reminiscent of Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance marches. It has a very noble trio section that comes on just after the bit that we heard. And he, I think, had an implicit understanding of his audience, of people who, in those days, this is in the 1930s, had an idea of what British music should sound like, and he wrote it for them.
Andrew, your choice was also used as a radio signature tune. Tell us about that.
It was, yes. I spent a lot of my childhood learning how to deepen my frown by listening to classical music, but this did the opposite, and it's Vivian Ellis's Coronation Scot.
Thank you. Andrew, this is music that makes me want to say, by Timothy, what's that ticking noise, Steve?
Absolutely. There's suddenly a whole world of Enid Blyton and Joyce Grenfell, a whole sort of incredibly scented world of Britishness comes out of that. You can practically see the train cutting its way through the fields towards Taunton from Paddington at a certain time in the evening on a Friday night.
But it's also the perfect theme tune of Paul Temple, isn't it? So it's associated with middle-class girls on morphine, isn't it? And mysterious murders, too.
That's a whole other subject. I don't know if we'll get the time for that this evening, the girls on morphine. But yes, you're quite right. You know, sometimes I wonder about light music, whether it falls into disfavour because the tunes have just become almost too popular. People recognise them almost too much. But I think it's almost worth pushing that aside and remembering what the value of the music is in itself. And Coronation Scott, for me, just has such an exuberant, incredibly intelligent, colourful sense of what it is to live in this country with this weather and these values.
I want to throw this out to the audience now, because I'm curious what your relationship with this music is and what it stirs in you. You know, maybe your feelings about it are ambivalent or nostalgic or... Yes, sir?
Yes, it all brings back wonderful memories of a happy era. And I can remember as a small boy being woken up in the morning to what was then the light programme. And this music was played with an intermittent time check. I just wonder if you can, the panel can recall when that ceased to happen and you know, the light programme gradually got, well, I'd call it dumbed down, really, if I compare it with what was played at that time. But there was, I can't remember what it was called. It was an early morning programme of the type of music we'd been listening to, and periodically you would have the time check.
Well, I think that was when Radio 2 was invented, which would be 1967.
Yeah. And in a broader sense, what you witnessed, really, from the birth of rock and roll on, really, so you're really talking 56... 57, it's a downscaling of the centrality of this music in British life. You know, it just petered away, and, you know, the figures speak for themselves. The BBC, under whose auspices we're here enjoying this music and speaking tonight, at one time had 8 light music orchestras. It's now got 1.
My first acquaintance with the Dvorak Slavonic Dances was hearing them on their early morning programmes. It wasn't all entirely very light music, but it was, you know, certainly a wonderful programme.
Yeah. I was fortunate to grow up in South Africa with a piano stool full of English music my dad used to play. In fact, I found some pieces recently that he actually composed when he was in South Africa with the RAF and sent back to England. But what I think about that is actually it made me feel very English. And going to see British films every Saturday evening and laughing at Carry On films and all that sort of thing, that made me really want to go to England. That's why I'm in London, actually, because I really was obsessed about England. And I think we mustn't forget the BBC World Service. That was really, really important in my life, listening to lots of those tunes were played on the World Service.
So what did it conjure for you then, sitting there in South
it's
Africa?
Just being
what
British.
Was that quality of Britishness?
It's exactly what you said. It's that British feeling of well-being. This is going to be a really good place to live. And when I arrived in 1973, it was. I'm not so sure it's like that now, but I still like being here.
Okay, well, I'm curious about why the idea of lightness was so important in this period. Is this a kind of a post-war idea, Simon, that the blackout is over, so all things light become something to focus on?
Well, the blackout's over, of course, but life is grim until really the early 1950s. Rationing is there until 1953. You've got in 1947 the coldest winter in living memory when fuel is still rationed. And you can't get petrol. You know, these are hard times, and people are... There is more or less full employment, but people don't have high standards of living. And one of the great functions of the BBC in those days was to cheer people up. And light music, as I said, the BBC was the great patron of light music in this country, not just for pillaging it for theme tunes for its programmes, but also, as Andrew said, having 8 orchestras that would go around playing it. It was performing this public service of keeping morale going at a time when we'd won the war, but many people thought we were losing the peace. And I think that is really quite important and quite central. That's why lightness mattered.
Does it also fit with a broader kind of cultural idea about lightness, Andrew? Somehow that this is the era in which, you know, refinement was seen as a great quality, you know, in food, in things that people consuming. You know, this is the era where things with the bits taken out are really kind of glamorous and sexy.
Yes, I think there is that. You know, there's a certain sense in which people are ready for a sort of easy tasting menu. After the sort of austerity and the difficulty in the dark times. But also, I think we're moving slowly through the 50s towards an explosion in popular culture. This is part of popular culture and its movement into the centre of our lives, that suddenly you don't simply measure your identity and your musical tastes against very high culture and high seriousness, but you can also suddenly live a life in which the stuff you enjoy to dance around to, the stuff that accompanies adverts and that sort of jingles through your life, can also have a validity, if you like, of its own. And this is even before pop music made claims, as it does now, for all sorts of new seriousness. This music suddenly wanted to appeal to a sense of democracy in us that was quite new. The authority was being questioned.
What killed light music, Simon?
Well, the Beatles. The Rolling Stones, the counterculture of the 60s, and the fact that it became associated with people in floral print dresses and trilbies. That's what killed it.
I wonder whether, though, those more, what we might think of as more countercultural forms of music are reabsorbing the influence of light music. I want you to listen now to a track called Slip Into Something More Comfortable by Kenobi. Now, to my ear, Andrew, the ghosts of Sailing By haunt this music.
Definitely. I completely love that. In fact, I want that to be played at my funeral. No, certainly slipping into something more comfortable. I love that. And I think, it pushes the envelope. It really does. You know, it's soporific. You could slightly tune out of the world to that music. And I know that people would immediately say, well, that's not what classical music is for. It's to tune you back in and tune you into yourself and tradition. Of course, and there are aspects of light music that does that. But this is an example of the kind which almost sort of zaps you with its sort of liquid easiness. There was a piece of music that was never more than 30 seconds long, which used to accompany the advertising jingle at the cinema for Pearl and Dean. It went fa 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 fa. And whenever ever I hear that, no matter how banal it might be and how simplistic, it is that Proustian Madeleine. It takes me right back to the Regal Cinema in Saltcoats in Ayrshire in 1972, waiting for the Revenge of the Killer Bees to appear. You know, it's just magical music.
Okay, well, light music is pleasantly short, so I'm going to stop now while we're still enjoying ourselves. So don't get too excited, but it'd be awfully nice if you'd show your appreciation for my guests, Simon Heffer and Andrew O'Hagan.
Matthew Sweet presented Proms Plus, which took place at the Royal College of Music earlier today. Some lovely memories there. And, of course, light music at the BBC, well, Friday Night is Music Night has been presenting that every Friday for, well, more than 60 years now. Quite a long time, Petrock.
Yeah, and you go back to day one, don't you?
I could have been listening, but only just. I wasn't quite old enough for that then.
And if you're going to gratuitously plug your Radio 2 show on Radio 3, I should also say I play lots of light music on my breakfast show every morning from 6:30 to 9 over on Radio 3.
I was going to ask which station that might be on, but you've told us. Petrock Trelawney and Ken Bruce here at the Royal Albert Hall. The Prommers are making their traditional thank you for their donations here.
Yeah, up to £23,000 they've raised for musical charities so far, which is fantastic. Music with a royal connection in our light music prom tonight here on Radio 2 and on Radio 3. In a moment, the Three Elizabeths by the so-called King of Light Music, Eric Coates, a three-movement work celebrating Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother, and our present monarch. But first of all, William Walton, his march Crown Imperial, first performed at the coronation of George VI in 1937.
And you may have heard it more recently at the end of the wedding ceremony of Prince William and Catherine Middleton, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, in 2011. It's certainly one of William Walton's most popular pieces on the concert hall, which is perhaps just as well, because there aren't that many coronations or royal weddings these days. You can't rely on them for income, really, can you? If you're a composer, no, not really. It's very much like it's in the tradition, at any rate, of the Elgar Pomp and Circumstance March, the most famous of which appears, of course, at the last night of the proms every year. It's a great big, brilliant fanfare-like opening, and again, a closing like that, and one of those huge, stately tunes right in the middle of it.
Well, silence falling on the Royal Albert Hall, the BBC Concert Orchestra in place on the stage, and behind the bust of Sir Henry Wood, Roderick Elmes sits at the mighty Royal Albert Hall organ, a fine instrument of which we'll be hearing much in part two of this concert. Barry Wordsworth bows from the rostrum, opens part two of our prom with Walton's Crown Imperial.
magnificently stirring sound of Walton's Crown Imperial, played here at the Proms by the BBC Concert Orchestra and Barry Wordsworth, with the magnificent organ of the Royal Albert Hall, which you don't just hear in the Royal Albert Hall, but you feel in the fibre of your being.
The vibrations are amazing, aren't they? Eric Coates next, his Three Elizabeths Suite. Elizabeth Tudor in the first movement, Springtime in Angus in the second, a celebration of the Queen Mother, and then to end another march, Youth of Britain, representing the then Princess Elizabeth as she was our current Queen. The idea suggested to Coates by a vicar from Barnes.
We'll be right back.
Barry Wordsworth, conductor laureate of the BBC Concert Orchestra, leading the Three Elizabeths Suite for Orchestra by Eric Coates. Elizabeth Tudor, the first movement, Springtime in Angus, portrait of the then Queen, later became Queen Mother, and the last movement, Youth of Britain, work written during the Second World War. Great optimism in that depiction of Princess Elizabeth. Used as a signature tune for something or other, that wasn't it, the last movement?
Yeah, there are times when age has its advantages. Yes, the Forsyte Saga in 1967. That's what it was used for, the last drama the BBC did in black and white. And they were very sorry it was in black and white as well. Back to Malcolm Arnold now for his four English dances. The first set of those, he wrote two sets of four, as well, of course, as sets of Scottish and Cornish dances.
Should be doing the Cornish ones tonight, shouldn't
they? Well, they should be doing the Scottish ones, really. They are in the style of country dances, country folk tunes, rather than real ones. Hence, the movements don't actually have titles, only tempo directions. The first one is called Andantino, which translates to me as sweetly melancholic. The second movement is Vivace, that's lively. Third one is mournful, mesto. It starts with a bassoon, which unfortunately is entirely right for the bassoon. It is traditionally a mournful instrument, we must say.
But with integrity.
Well, indeed. And the fourth movement, Allegro Risoluto, is rousing and begins with a rather forceful performance by the French horns.
Well, there's a big Arnold family presence here tonight, at least half a dozen members of the Arnold family. Piers Burton Page, his biographer, is here as well. Barry Wordsworth returns to conduct set one of Arnold's English dance. BBC Concert Orchestra here at the Proms, live on Radio 2 and Radio 3.
The BBC Concert Orchestra, Barry Wordsworth with Malcolm Arnold's Four English Dances, set one. And loud applause for bassoonist Margaret Pollock and flautist Ileana Ruhrmann.
Brass section sounding fantastic, aren't they?
Playing beautifully this evening, as of course they often do.
Well, we finish this great celebration of light music with a splendid melody of BBC Radio signature tunes of yesteryear, woven together by that master arranger and composer Gordon Langford, longtime collaborator with the BBC Concert Orchestra, pianist on many a Friday night is music night over the years. Notepads ready, see how many you can recognise.
Barry Wordsworth and the BBC Concert Orchestra. Roderick Elms being Sandy McPherson during that at the organ. With Gordon Langford's Say It With Music. Now, Petrock, we need to go through what the titles were in that. I'll begin with Say It With Music, which was the easy one. That's Jack Payne's programme. Then, of course, Barwick Green, The Archers.
Spice of Life, Music Hall, Hancock's Half Hour, of course, immediately recognisable. And Monday Night at 8.
The Dales, Mrs. Dale's Diary, as it was before that. The Parade of the Tin Soldiers was the theme to Toy Town. The Navy Lark, a lot of people got that. Tuesday Serenade, Valse Serenade, the title of that. And then, of course,
The Sleepy Lagoon, Cue the Seagulls, Desert Island Discs, Roses from the South, Grand Hotel, Calling All Workers, that's an easy one, Music While You Work. Take It From Here, Here's to the Next Time, which Henry Hall had as his theme tune.
Much Binding in the Marsh followed that. It's That Man Again, Itmar, Keep Smiling from Reginald Fort, then the Alpenruhr Waltz, Sandy McPherson's famous piece.
With A Song in My Heart, two-way family favourites, of course.
And I'm not sure, I didn't hear Wagoners Walk and PM, but I'm told they were in there. But I've heard this piece so often and never recognised all of them in it.
21 tunes.
Beautifully arranged by Gordon Langford. Barry Wordsworth coming back on to further great applause from our audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. And the orchestra stand to receive their acknowledgement. There's another prom taking place later this evening. At 10:15 on Radio 3, you'll be able to hear it, featuring music by, believe it or not, Frank Zappa. And this features a car chase, a love-in, a coughing mountain, a choir of stenographers, and a swine pig called Gregory. It's Frank Zappa's The Adventures of Gregory Peccary, that plus a piece by Nancaro, and Philip Glass's Symphony No. 10, played by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin tonight, 10:15 on Radio 3.
Yes, we get very varied late night on Radio 3. Radio 3, the home of the proms, at least one concert every night. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, stalwarts of the season, give tomorrow night's concert. I'll be back here to introduce a lovely concert on Saturday, which includes Beethoven 5 and the Blue Danube Waltz. It all happens at Radio 3. Full details at bbc.co.uk/proms. Barry Wordsworth is back on stage. Ken, I'm afraid for us, the party is over. What fun we've had.
It's been a terrific evening. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And working with you has been almost a pleasure.
We must do this again next year.
Yes, indeed we must. But for tonight, we have to go. I'm going to be playing some more music and looking forward to some other programmes on Radio 2 in a moment.
I'm going to hand you back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House. From Ken and from me, good night.
Good night.
Ken Bruce and Petrock Trelawney at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight, and for Radio 2, a simultaneous broadcast on two BBC networks. And if you came in some way into that concert and you'd like to hear it again, then you can do so tomorrow afternoon on Radio 3 when it forms our Proms Repeat programme during afternoon on 3. That's all from 2 o'clock tomorrow. Or if you prefer, you can hear it online, where you'll find all of the proms sitting there for 7 days after their initial broadcast, and plenty more besides as well. bbc.co.uk/radio3. Well, as Ken said, we'll be back at the proms here on Radio 3 in 45 minutes' time, or actually, no, an hour from now, for a late-night rendezvous with a brand-new symphony by Philip Glass and music for player piano by Conlan, Nancaro and others, all from 10:15 this evening. And Petrock briefly mentioned there that Oliver Nussum will be conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night in a programme of 20th century music by Hans-Werner Henze, amongst others, his Barcarolla, composed in 1979. And music by Stravinsky, and to end, Michael Tippett's Second Symphony. So that's our prom tomorrow night, live here on BBC Radio 3 at 7:30. Well, we have a little time to go before our next programme tonight, which takes a look at negative thinking. Now, you might imagine that it's a bit counterproductive, when in fact, according to the poet and the novelist Patrick McGuinness, it's actually vital to the life of the mind and to the progress of thought. He calls his investigation into the subject Think Negative, and you can hear it at 9:30 tonight here on Radio 3. In the meantime, I have music from Mexico. In fact, a piece dubbed Mexico's second national anthem. It's by Arturo Márquez, who shot to fame with this piece just 20 years ago when he composed it. And this is the orchestra that had a great deal to do with its success, I would wager. Something of a theme tune for them, the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra of Venezuela, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. Dance on number 2 by Marquez. The Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra of Venezuela was conducted there by Gustavo Dudamel. Sadly, not at the Proms this year, with all their swaying and their juggling of trumpets. It's just coming up to 9:30 now. Ian Skelly here to guide you through our programmes tonight on Radio 3. The music of Philip Glass will feature in our late prom in 45 minutes' time. It's the UK premiere of his 10th symphony tonight. And also that curious race through the adventures of Gregory Peccary by Frank Zappa, always worth a listen to there. There's also a study for Play a Piano by Nan Caro in the programme. The Aurora Orchestra gives the prom, and their conductor, Nicholas Colon, is there at 10:15 tonight. And then at 11 o'clock, we'll be joining Fiona Talkington for the next edition of Late Junction this week. She's been charting many of the highlights that featured at this year's WOMAD Festival amid the rainstorms last weekend. We broadcast plenty of concerts live from the WOMAD Festival, but Fiona was there with her microphone and indeed Radio 3's to record plenty more. And you can hear the results at 9:45, in fact, tonight after our late prom. But it's now 9:30 and time to think negative. The novelist, poet and professor of French literature at Oxford University, Patrick McGuinness, considers the vital importance of negation.